Hi there. Welcome to the recording of a policy brief launch event titled Pastoralist Voices, Global Choices, Why We Need Pro-Pastoralist Policies. The event took place on September 26, 2025 in Brussels, Belgium, and online. We hope you enjoy listening and that what you hear is both insightful and inspiring.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm really honored to be here today to be launching the policy brief and the research report that I co-authored with three colleagues who are hopefully also here online, Chiara Razzano, Julie Kleman, and Anne Waters-Byers. As an academic, I strongly believe in the importance of producing evidence-based policies. And for this research, we analyzed all the available scientific evidence on pastoralism with a focus on East Africa, and we try to develop policy recommendations that are based on that scientific available research and evidence. I really want to thank also CITSE, who is hosting us today from Brussels. So we have a panel of six distinguished panelists. It's a bit of a logistical challenge because three of us are here joining me from Brussels. I will introduce them in a moment. And three other panelists are joining us online. So I want to thank all of them for their participation. As a scholar activist, I really believe in producing research that is relevant to society. I believe that research is useful if it is read and appropriated and can be directly used by the people, social movements, and civil society actors that are trying to make this world a better place and who are fighting for their rights. This is why I'm really honored to be launching this report today alongside a number of networks and global organizations which have endorsed our reports, and I'm naming CITSE, AFSA, the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa, CELEP, the European Network for Lobbies for East African Pastoralists, of course, Coventry University, which is my home institution, and the East African Group of the International Year of Rangelands and Pastoralists 2026. In terms of our panelists, I just want to introduce our six speakers very quickly, but then I'll pass on the floor to them. We have here next to me in Brussels, Masingoi Masai from Tanzania, also next to me, Joseph Olesangai from Tanzania, and my panel also joining us, Masai from Tanzania. And online, we have Saverio Quatley calling us from the UK, editor of the Journal of Nomadic Peoples. We have Michael Odhiambo from the Rift Valley Institute, and Million Belai, general coordinator of AFSA, the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa. Welcome to all of you. We have designed this event in a very interactive way. So I have prepared two rounds of questions for each of our six panelists. So what I've done, I've sent to them the policy brief and the research report that we have co-authored, and I will be asking them to react to it and share their perceptions or link it to their personal experiences with pastoralism. So we will start with Saverio. Saverio, the brief identifies five key measures to support pastoralism, especially measures that the EU, but also East African states, could take on board and try to implement. Why do you think it is important to put pastoralism on the agenda of policymakers? Over to you, Saverio.
Thank you very much, Priscilla. Pastoralism has been receiving quite a lot of attention recently, but often it is for the wrong reason. In policy especially, it receives very rarely the right kind of attention. So too often it is either ignored or targeted with programs that try to replace it with something more modern, rarely with success. But modernization itself, at least as promoted in development policies, has now been made obsolete. As in the face of climate change, it is unsustainable and ultimately catastrophic. So on the other hand, climate change is spreading unpredictable variability into food systems, and managing unpredictable variability is precisely where pastoralism excels. So while global agriculture depends on stability and the considerable amount of energy needed to secure it, Pastoralism has specialized in managing the risk associated with climate variability and making use of the opportunities offered by these natural conditions. It does so sustainably and with very little energy inputs through mobility, flexibility in the management strategies, health diversity, and shared governance of land. These are not fallback options. They are what makes pastoralism especially adapted to climate extremes. Yet policies often misread the flexibility of this approach as disorder and portray its pastoralists as inherently vulnerable. So pastoralism is underrepresented in development plans and climate finance, and so many interventions, even when aimed at increasing resilience, actually undermine it. By blocking mobility, privatizing land, or imposing fixed infrastructure, development intervention disable the very strategies that allow pastoralists to manage climate risk and produce high-quality food and valuable fibers from non-arable land. At times when the world urgently needs to focus on low emissions, pastoralism is a rare example of ecologically integrated food production, sustainable and aligned with climate realities. So this is why pastoralism must be at the center of the policy agenda. Today, and in the face of the ecological future that we can now expect with considerable certainty, supporting pastoralism is more than ever a smart policy. So that's very good that you are pushing for that.
And I think we have just heard from Saverio that there is a lot of misunderstanding still about pastoralism. So could you please explain what pastoralism is for beginners? Thank you.
Thank you, Priscilla. Pastoralism is a way of life that is centered on herding of nomadic livestock. The nomadic nature of pastoralism enriches the soil. So the pastoralism is also a climate-friendly and environmental-friendly practice because of their mobility nature, because of their indigenous knowledge of practicing nomadic livestock keeping and herding. In order for pastoralism to happen or to take place, it has its own trinity of existence. The trinity of pastoralism is land, people, and livestock. Land is majorly the key in the umbilical cord of pastoralism. Land binds the people with their ancestors in different perspectives. Land is where the trees grow, the trees that we use them for our sacrifices. We use them as sacred places for our cultures. Land is where grasses grow and used by our livestock for their food. Land is where we have the water points for our animals and how livestock is connected. Livestock, we use them for our social relationships. Pastoralists use the livestock to make friendship, to use them as a dowry payment during the marriage process. Livestock are also used as nutritious in terms of food security. We use our livestock to trade, we call it barter trade. You exchange your cow for maize, you exchange your cow for beans and everything. You slaughter your cow, you get meat, you use the cow, you milk it, you get milk and everything. That composes a balanced diet for pastoralists. Livestock are used for economic benefits. We sell the cow, we take our kids to school. We slaughter a cow, we use the herd for our bedding. We use the animal skin to sell them and later on are being used to make shoes and everything. Then they use them as a symbol of a cultural identity. So I think livestock in a nutshell, it's a holistic thing or identity of pastoralism.
Thank you so much. That was such a brilliant introduction. I want to pass on to our pastoralist youth here. We often hear that one of the main threats to pastoralism is modernization policies. So as a young Maasai, my final, do you feel that pastoralism is something of the past or something that has a future?
I don't see pastoralism as lifestyle of the past. I believe it still has a great relevance for the future. To us, cattle are not only a source of food and income, but also a symbol of identity, as she said, pride, connection of our ancestors. Even so, times are changing and new challenges are emerging. Pastoralism continues to give meaning to our lives and offer solutions that remain viable today. While challenges such as land pressure, climate change, and modernization have affected it, pastoralism continues to be a resilient way of life that supports millions across Eastern Africa. Personally, growing up in a pastoralist community, I have witnessed how livestock remains at the center of our economy, culture, and identity. Therefore, I will explain this in 4 points, which are economic contribution, environmental values, climate change adaptation and mitigation, and cultural and social values. I will start with economic contribution. Pastoralism provides employment and livelihood for up to 20 million people in Eastern Africa, in Tanzania, Kenya, and beyond. It takes important contributions to national gross domestic products through the sale of livestock, milk, hides, meat, and skins, and other related products. For my own family, livestock has always been the backbone of our household income, ensuring food security and enabling us to access education and healthcare. Point number two, environmental values. Pastoralism is also deeply connected to the environment. Pastoralists shape and sustain the rangeland landscape of Eastern Africa by moving cattle seasonally, preserving some areas specifically to be used during the drought season and other areas during the rainy season. Through grazing, controlled fire, and the management of bush allotment, they help maintain biodiversity and enhance soil and water cycles. Third point, climate change and adaptation and mitigation. Pastoralists are uniquely adapted to climate variability, unlike farmers who depend on fixed and land use. Pastoralists rely on mobility and traditional knowledge of weather patterns, grazing cycles, and water sources. This low external input system is both climate smart and sustainable, showing a path towards future climate neutral agri-food systems. From experience, I know how my community quickly adjusts herd movement in response to drought and a strategy that has allowed us to survive in harsh conditions. And the last point is cultural and social values. Pastoralism is not only an economic activity, it's a way of life, as I have said. Important cultural and social values. Among the Maasai, livestock is central to rituals, marriages, and rite of passages. Cows are seen not just as wealthy, but as symbol of life and connection with our ancestors. Our traditions are passed from one generation to another one through oral tradition. Personally, I feel proud to belong to a community where our identity and heritage are inseparable from pastoralism. Thank you.
Thank you so much, my panel. It is a very inspiring summary of why pastoralism continues to be relevant in this 21st century. I will now pass on to Joseph Olesangai, who is a Maasai human rights lawyer, also from Ngorongoro, northern Tanzania. What would you say, Joseph, are the key challenges facing pastoralists today?
Thank you very much, Priscilla. Despite actually the resilience that my colleague has said and the value that pastoralism has had, pastoralism is facing enormous challenges in East Africa, but I think I'll say something about Tanzania. The first, which has been a long-standing, is induced scarcity through dispossession. For many years, and through the colonial time and throughout all the government that we have had, land has been taken in many ways, and I'm referring to initially through conservation, through hunting, through, of course, some modernization, through farming and different others, and then now carbon is coming. So this development of other people is inducing scarcity and is taking away the land, and this has been a problem to the pastoralists. But particularly, the impact that the pastoralists felt is not only that the land is going, is the livestock dying because there is no grazing area. Is livestock confiscation because of some of the areas declared as illegal for access. The other point is bad policies towards pastoralism. Many people, particularly in Tanzania, at least the post-independent government, see pastoralism as the life of the past. That's what my colleague has just said, is not. And this is the problem. And because they see it's the life of the past, they use all muscles of the state to make sure that they dismantle this way of life. And so other than giving everyone a way to develop, they use the resources to dismantle pastoralism as a way of life. And this goes not only in bad laws. From experience in Tanzania, for example, we have a ministry they called Ministry of Livestock and Fisheries, which literally has nothing to do in a positive development toward pastoralists. They never say about the land for the pastoralists, while others are saying land for their individual sector. A third point is human rights abuses facing the pastoralists. Beyond what happened in police in Tanzania, for example, about the torture and everything, no communities in Tanzania face a systematic abuse like the pastoralists. For grazing in the land you have known for centuries, being criminalized. This abuse can take in form of beatings, limited access to the resources like water, like the grasses and different others. The other issue is structural discrimination. What we are facing now, what are we always speaking about in Europe and every other, is because we are being discriminated as people. We don't have equal chance like any other community to survive. And this is, as my colleague said, we are in a very harsh environment, very dry areas, but where rights are not being respected. There are many different solutions which are wrong solutions to many issues. So we have, for example, the climate issues, but the solution being brought take away right to access of the pastoralists to the land.
Thank you so much, Joseph. We'll come back to the issue of false climate solutions, and we have asked actually one panelist to speak to the challenge raised by carbon credit projects that are coming to your territories. I will now pass on to Michael Odhiambo. So 2026 has been declared by the UN General Assembly as the International Year of Rangelands and Pastoralists. Tell us a bit more, Michael, about what are the objectives of the International Year and what kind of vision of pastoralism is the International Year promoting? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Priscilla, and thanks to all the panelists who have spoken so far. I want to start from where Saverio ended. Saverio explained why it is important that pastoralism is brought into the mainstream of policy. The International Year of Rangelands and Pastoralists aims exactly to do that at the global level. The first thing that will happen if we have an International Year of Rangelands and Pastoralism is that the profile of pastoralism at the global level is raised. But then the International Year is not just 2026. The International Year is a process which has been going on for a while. And over the last couple of years, people who are interested in this issue have been mobilizing and sharing ideas and networking and creating opportunities for making the link between pastoralism and other global imperatives that are promoted at the UN. All the panelists who have spoken, what comes out clearly from what they're saying is that one of the challenges that pastoralism as a livelihood system faces is the fact that it is seen in isolation from the rest of what is happening in the economy, in governance, in environmental management. And yet, what is clear from what everybody is saying is that pastoralism is much more than just nomadic livestock keeping. It is a way of life, it's a system of governance, it's an economic activity, it's a way of managing the ecosystem, it's a cultural system. In order to do that, in order to make sure that those aspects come out clearly, the International Year of Rangelands and Pastoralists provides an opportunity for making linkages between the challenges that pastoralists face, but also the opportunities within pastoralism as a livelihood and land use system to make linkages with other global agenda. Some people have mentioned climate change, some people have mentioned human rights, some people have mentioned carbon credits, international development. It is at the UN where all the key actors in issues that impact on pastoralism, both positively and negatively, sit and talk together. And the opportunity for pastoralism and pastoralists to be able to engage at that level, at the global level, is really unique. And it's a way that enables us to realize this vision of ensuring that pastoralism is brought to the center of policy making, of governance, of decision making, and pastoralists themselves become key actors in defining how their livelihood system is managed.
Thank you so much, Michael. I will now pass on to Million. So one of the things we did in the report was to analyze the national climate contributions and the national biodiversity strategies of different East African countries, so Uganda, Tanzania, Ethiopia, and Kenya, to see how livestock and pastoralism are discussed or mentioned or addressed in these strategies, to really see the link between pastoralism and climate and biodiversity strategies. So I've asked Million to give us some feedback on how he perceived this section of the report. So over to you, Million.
Thank you very much. I found this research very important because it mirrors what we at AFSA have seen with agroecology. We recently looked at how agroecology is reflected in African NDCs and NBSAF, and we found out that 20% of climate contribution even mention it, despite its proven potential. We see the same with pastoralism. In most cases, pastoralists are invisible in these strategies. And when livestock is mentioned, it is usually framed as a threat to climate or biodiversity, rather than as part of the solution. The real contributions of pastoralism is mobility, its adaptability, its low emissions, and biodiversity stewardship are not recognized. The documents often talk about livestock in very narrow terms: breed reflection, breed selection, efficiency, or managing animals within crop systems. They rarely make the distinction between industrial livestock operations and pastoralism, and this is a very serious mistake. The impacts of factory-scale livestock and the impacts of mobile pastoralism are completely different. This lack of recognition is not only a missed opportunity, it can also be harmful. Uganda's NDC, for example, sets targets for zero grazing, and its biodiversity strategy calls for fencing to prevent conflict with wildlife. Both measures directly undermine mobility, which is at the heart of pastoralism. At the same time, there are some positive openings, especially in NBSAF. Kenya's and Tanzania's strategy call for the promotion of traditional knowledge and practice. Uganda's NBSAF, even though its NDC is hostile to pastoralism, actually embraces agroecological approach and recognizes communities as stewards of biodiversity. Ethiopia's NBSAF describes pastoralism as custodians of biodiversity. But in the same document, it also proposes expanding protected areas, which risks restricting them. So there are contradictions. The lesson for me is that we need much greater coherence. We cannot afford climate and biodiversity strategies that undermine pastoralism while claiming to protect ecosystems. What is needed is real interministerial coordination and an honest recognition that pastoralism, like agroecology, is not a problem to be managed, but a solution to be strengthened. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Million. That was really excellent. So what I will do now in the second round is to present quickly the kind of measures that we are advocating for, both the EU to support and East African countries to implement. And I will ask each of our panelists to quickly respond to these. So measure one that we are promoting in the report basically talks about land. So we call for supporting rangelands as commons and communal land management systems. We call for the protection of mobility. Mobility has been highlighted by many of you. And we call also for protecting the rights of communities to be able to make the decisions for and about developments on their lands. Some of you have mentioned problems regarding conservation projects or climate projects. So protecting the right of people to be able to make themselves the decisions about the future of their land seems to us really important. So I will pass on to Michael. What do you have to say about land and how to protect land in the future for pastoralists? What would be some good ideas in your opinion?
Thank you very much, once again, Priscilla. I think one of the panelists mentioned that land was, you know, like the core issue if you're talking about pastoralist rights. And my colleagues from Tanzania also mentioned, talking about human rights, talked about land grabs and so on. I think the way land is perceived by different value systems, but also different livelihood systems, is the core tension between pastoralism and other systems. Even when we say that land is at the center of pastoralism, pastoralists don't perceive land as something that you want to own and parcel out and, you know, individualize. They perceive it as a common, and it is particularly important because of the resources on it. Not land qua land, not land as such, but land in terms of the resources that it has and how those resources are useful for sustaining the livelihood system. And the history of pastoralism, especially in East Africa, the challenges of pastoralism can be traced to the interventions that colonial and post-colonial governments and investment interests have brought into the land of the pastoralists. And this problem arises from the fact that the way these other people and livelihood systems and modernity perceive land is very different to the way pastoralists perceive it. So just as the policy document has recommended, it is important to start with what pastoralists do so that law and policy enable pastoralists to do what they do with the land. And that includes mobility, includes communal land tenure systems, includes local level decision making about land, includes cross-border mobility, and so on. So the challenge that we have, and it is evident in Kenya where the Community Land Act was supposed to be helping this, but we make two steps forward and kind of three steps backward. The challenge we have is that the mainstream understanding of property rights over land is one that is diametrically opposed to the way pastoralists relate to the land. And when we think about making these policy recommendations, we should find innovative ways that legal systems and political systems to enable pastoralist mechanisms or land use of land management to be integrated into policies and laws at national and regional level. And we have examples in Kenya. We have examples from the pastoralist policy framework from the African Union, the framework and guidelines on land. They all provide a starting point. The challenge is how we move from having them in the document to applying it on the ground.
Thank you so much, Michael. That was really, really great. The second measure that we are advocating is really about how to ensure that pastoralism can fully contribute and continue contributing to food security and nutrition, but also economic resilience in the rangelands. So examples of some measures that we are proposing are mobile abattoirs, livestock insurance, supporting value chains for meat and dairy, especially for women. So Saverio, could you say a bit about what kind of measures could support pastoralism economic contribution, please?
The very best way to support food and water security in pastoral systems and economic resilience, of course, is by being serious about protecting pastoral land and mobility. That is, protecting land in ways that are functional to practicing pastoralism, not per se, as Michael very, very well said. This is the first measure recommended in the brief, and I'm very glad of that. And it's also is a recommendation in a very large number of scientific reports over the last 50 years, although to little effect. Pastoralism has tried for centuries in extreme environments because of its sophisticated, adapted, and resilient skills. So the worst challenges emerge when this logic, when this knowledge, this capacity is obstructed. When mobility is blocked, land is lost, or kept in ways that are not functional to practicing pastoralism, and institutions are undermined. When allowed to function in its own terms, pastoralism creates value in multiple ways. Ecologically, as it has been said, because it maintains rangelands and carbon sinks and biodiversity reserves. Socially, it supports strong networks of mutual aid and food security across regions. And economically, as it supplies a significant share of meat and milk to both rural and urban markets, often with far lower public investment than other sectors receive. Of course, the logic of pastoralism has evolved over time, and this can continue. Development policies can help strengthening it. Mobility-friendly service provision, for example, is one way. Collapsible water containers filled by trucks, for example, in Sudan, used by herders as mobile water points while tracking best grazing opportunities. Or the timed ponds built along migration corridors in Chad, designed to provide water when needed, but then to dry out later so that they wouldn't attract permanent settlement. These are solutions that remove obstacles rather than entrenching them. Too often, development efforts have pushed technical fixes that enable the persistence of barriers instead of dismantling them. If we want real economic resilience, we must invest in what pastoralism already does best, which is living with unpredictable variability and turning it into value.
Thank you so much, Saverio, for this very clear contribution. So measure 3 that we are proposing focuses on people-led mobile service delivery. And when I'm talking here about service delivery, this is both for people and livestock. Why is that important in your experience? I'm thinking about health, education, but also veterinary services, and of course about ensuring gender responsive service delivery. So over to you, Nasingoi.
Thank you so much, Priscilla. I am thinking of health in this perspective. First, health is a holistic thing. It comprises of physical well-being, psychological well-being, and everything in it. So if we want the pastoralist to live in a proper way or to live in a pleasant way, then first the policies have to be changed. They should not evict people without their consent. They should not come and develop or construct any development industries in their land without their consent. This will psychologically torture them. Then we have different policies in their country, like the health policies, that we have only maybe one physical hospital in a particular area. This should not be the case. We need to have hospitals everywhere where we have Maasai's or pastoral communities moving from one place to another. This is to help them to reduce the number of mortality rates, to vaccinate the kids, and antenatal care should be provided. Also, in education, I think we need to increase the access of formal education in all these places where we have the pastoralist communities, not only because of having physical school, but to increase the rate of formal education to the pastoral community, but not at the expense of their indigenous knowledge and systems. We also need to have the veterinary services. As much as we know that the pastoral have their own knowledge of keeping or treating their animals, their livestock, we have climate change, we have erupting diseases. So if we have the veterinary people going to where the pastoralists are, we will reduce the number of outbreak of diseases. This will not only help the livestock, but also will prevent this pastoralist community from contaminating other diseases from the livestock.
Thank you so much. Wonderful. So our fourth measure talks about the role of pastoralism in climate and biodiversity strategies. So I want to invite my friend Noe to talk to this point because she participated in some research that we did last year on the impact of carbon credits in rangelands. You mentioned this is a false climate solution in your perspective. So I would be interested in hearing a bit more the kind of research that you did and what are the key learnings from that research. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Priscilla. And I have 4 key learnings from the research on carbon credits and pastoralism. The first one is pastoralism is already a climate and biodiversity solution. Second one, carbon credit projects in rangelands are risky. And the third one is separating people from nature doesn't work. You have seen the case of Ngorongoro and Loliondo. And the last one is the real green transition is pastoralist-led. And I will start by the first one. Pastoralism is already a climate and biodiversity solution. Through mobility and communal grazing, pastoralist project biodiversity reduce land degradation and even prevent wildfires. In fact, in many rangelands, the presence of herders and their animals keeps the land healthier than when it is left unused. This is why pastoralism should be fully recognized in national climate and biodiversity strategies like the NDC and NBSAP. Second one, carbon credit projects in rangelands are risky. As Priscilla said, yes, I was one of the people who conducted a carbon survey in our villages in Tanzania. We discovered that the projects are poorly regulated. In one, they often fail to ensure free, prior, and informed consent speak. They bring conflict between villages. Carbon projects introduce rotational grazing practices that restrict traditional Maasai grazing patterns and undermine pastoral mobility, a cornerstone of Maasai culture, rangeland sustainability. Also, the contracts are unclear. For example, a 40-year contract implemented in our villages feels like it's destroying the future of our generations. Third point is separating people from nature doesn't work. Many conservation approaches try to push people out of protected areas, but pastoralists are not a threat. They are stewards of this land, and as pastoralist community, we are not ready to leave our land. And the fourth word is the real green transition is pastoral-led. Instead of investing in carbon or biodiversity credits, we should support rangeland restoration and pastoralist management systems because it does the following. It protects the environment, it secures a sustainable future, it creates economic opportunity, it improves health quality of life, and also it promotes social equality. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I have to add that one of the reasons the three of you are here visiting different policymakers in Germany, Austria, France, and also the European Union is also to alert decision makers about the dangers of these projects. In particular, one project in your territories is being financed by Volkswagen, the car manufacturer, which is trying to become a net zero through these solutions. This is one of the reasons you're also here talking to our decision makers. I'll present now our measure 5, highlights the importance of pastoralist traditional institutions and also their participation in policy making, as well as measure 6, which talks about the need to address negative stereotypes against pastoralists. Joseph, you already mentioned that point a bit, that you continue to suffer structural discrimination and marginalization in your country. So why do you think pastoralist institutions continue to be relevant? I believe you have a system of traditional leadership. And why do you think these institutions are relevant today?
Thank you very much. So we as pastoralist people, the presenter said earlier, it is many factors that happen. So it's not just land, it's many things that happen on the land. And for pastoralism to function, there are many factors that has to play into. For us, we have institutions as people that regulate how we can sail through this complex environment, which I said earlier, of course, we are in one of the most dry lands, not only in East Africa, of course, even whatever the pastoralism happens in the Middle East and different other places, it is a climate that can tolerate complex environments. So we want the people, we want the government, we want those financing policies and certain ideas to respect our pastoral institutions. Because the way we practice our traditional knowledge, this has been tested not necessarily from the so-called the universities of this world, but through the real practice on the land. So we know, for example, as pastoralists, what happened where and when and why. Some people, for example, my colleague has just said about carbon, for example, they brought a rotational grazing, very crazy, 14 days. We, of course, are mobile people, but not crazy mobility. It's a strategic one, like you move because of many factors. Is the disease that, for example, influence? Is it the climate, variability? Is it rains? Or is certain minerals that everyone, I think, should be able to respect? Because this is our land, this is our life. And the minimum we can request anyone is just to respect. If they cannot add value into it, then at least respect. And we think many of the solutions being brought, for example, the institution that finance some of the solution to climate should try to respect the way of life of the pastoralist people. They should try to understand why after so many interventions, at least some of the biodiversity is happening, for example, in the pastoral land, is because these people understand the value of land. It's part of us. So we don't destroy because we fear losing money, because we have a morality to preserve. It adds value to our livelihoods. We believe ourselves as being part of the nature, and I think this is very important for donors, for everyone who try to finance some of the policies, to understand this as a minimal standard anyone can tolerate.
Thank you so much, Joseph. And indeed, many of these climate solutions rely on the commodification of nature. So the idea that if you don't pay people to protect their environment, they will destroy it, which I think is a misconception. Our last measure talks about the importance of research to address gaps in how we understand pastoralism. As was mentioned by many of our speakers, there continues to be a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings, and there are still a lot of things we don't know. So we call for research to be done in a participatory way, building on collaborative partnership with pastoralism themselves. We also call on approaches that decolonize how research is done. And I want to pass on to Milan for the last speaker to share a bit his perspective on the importance of also decolonizing food systems today. Why is that important, Milan?
Thank you very much. For me, the question of research is also the question of power. Who sets the agenda? On what value? Who defines what counts as knowledge? For too long, research on African food systems, including pastoralism, has been shared by external actors with little space for local voices. Decolonizing food systems means recognizing that pastoralists themselves are knowledge holders. They have managed variability, climate shocks, and biodiversity stewardship for centuries. Their oral traditions, ecological practices, and community governance are research in practice. But when external models dominate, whether from donors, universities, or governments, African knowledge is often dismissed as backward. This is a colonial legacy we must break. Participatory, community-led, African-rooted research is a way forward. It means designing methodologies together with pastoralists, respecting their priorities, and valuing the experiential knowledge alongside scientific data. Knowledge sovereignty is as vital as seed sovereignty or land sovereignty or the sovereignty of our food system in general. Without it, Africa will continue to be told what its solutions should be. With it, we can chart our own pathways, grounded in the lived wisdom of our people. That's why AFSA and our allies are calling for investment in Africa research institutions, pastoralist networks, and grassroots participation. Only then will our climate, biodiversity, and food strategies reflect Africa's true strengths rather than imported blueprints.
Thank you so much. So with that, we've concluded our two rounds of questions. So your first question was, given that pastoralism is about livestock, and a lot of people see livestock as a source of greenhouse gas emissions, so up to 70% of emissions from agriculture would come from livestock. So how can we address such problem in order to position pastoralism positively and favorably? So this connects to what was said earlier, that in many climate and biodiversity strategies, the approach to livestock is generally seen as a threat. And this also comes from the perception that many people have, certainly in the global north, that livestock production has developed mostly in an industrial way that is unsustainable and also contributes to emissions. So Saverio, maybe over to you and Michael, and who wants to address this question? Thanks.
I have replied quite clearly in the chat, and I invite everybody interested to read my reply. All I can add is that, unsurprisingly, in the global north, there is this concern, because it's a much more convenient concern than the real one, which is about stopping emissions from burning fossil fuel. So how to fight it? Well, I mean, obviously, there is a scientific level which has to do with re-examining and reframing the methodologies used for this kind of assessment. And then there is a climate justice level, which is about pointing out that countries that supposedly are big emitters because of their large livestock, in fact, they are not at all. And so there is little to discuss. If a country like Kenya has a 0.3% global greenhouse gas emissions altogether, including the cars, including the industry, then pastoralism is a percent of the of the agricultural emissions is a percent of the global emissions, then the whole discussion about mitigation by reducing pastoral emissions is quite meaningless, I think. You know, numbers have to be put in context. Now, we often read big proportions. Oh, pastoralism emission is 60% of the agricultural emission of Burkina. Yes, but the agricultural emission is 0.01 or 0.03. So, and nobody says that last bit, no? And everybody focuses on the 60%. So that is where we have to fight back, I think.
Thank you so much, Saverio. There was a second question by Fred, which is probably most tricky, and I don't know if anyone here can answer it, but we'll use our collective intelligence to try and address it. So the question reads, many pastoralists, especially women, rely on donkeys for transport and especially water. But these are now endangered through donkey skin trade, which is promoted especially by Chinese traders. Are these efforts to be involved in or support campaigns to stop such a trade? So what about the use of donkeys in the first place? And if there is an illegal skin trade going on, is there anything that we can do to stop it or contribute to these campaigns? Who wants to answer this tricky one? Okay, maybe Joseph will try.
I think the simple question is, it is true, particularly in East Africa, Tanzania and Kenya, in the couple of few years, maybe 5 or so, there's been a very serious pattern of slaughtering donkeys for skin and others. And I'm speaking from the Maasai community, which I already said, there is a limited resources, and particularly, for example, water. So a donkey for a Maasai, and sorry for my use of language, when someone marries, on the marriage date, of course, the new lady brought home will be given something, the cows, and women always remember to give the donkey. And they'll say, this is sort of the partner, like who will help you for something, like not carrying all your burden alone, but there is an assistant to carry. So, and actually the Maasai value donkeys so much because they facilitate much of the work of the people who do the much of the work, who are mostly women. So, for example, you are traveling 7 kilometers now in what we say the mobility. Who carries the burden is mostly donkeys. So, now bringing the business of slaughtering for a Maasai, it will mean two things. One, you are removing aid and you don't have any other means of transportation. And actually, even sometimes when the people are sick, and you don't have anything to use to carry, they use donkey to, of course, carry. So it's not only about the luggage. Now, for a Maasai, it is sort of haunting to see someone is slaughtering a donkey. The Maasai do not eat, they're not vegetarian mostly. They don't eat donkey meat because they believe there is a connection like a human, because it's almost doing human work. Is assisting human in transportation. So they don't eat. So now bringing a business that slaughter donkey will mean hunting that is not only an animal being killed, but is an animal that we have so much connection not to eat, not to kill, not to slaughter. But again, what will happen after that slaughtering massively that has happened in the couple of years. That's why they are much like stealing the donkeys to go and slaughter. It's not the normal trading because the Maasai will not trade the donkey like selling for anything. Of course, they buy, but they never sell. I have never seen at least a Maasai selling a donkey all my life. Never.
Thank you so much, Joseph. So maybe we can invite participants if they are aware of any initiatives or campaign to stop this illegal killing or
maybe something I didn't say. I think it's that point. We have to, for a fact, we have to find a solution to that.
Thank you, Joseph. There was a question from Isako Patrick Katelo from Kenya.
Thank you very much. My name is Patrick Katelo from Northern Kenya, Marsabit County, Yolo County, Samburu County. And not in Southern Ethiopia. That's where we are. I'm executive director for PASIDA. I really appreciate this discussion, having been a pastoralist myself. My question here is, where are we? Where are we in terms of pastoralism? We know this discussion has been there for ages, and we keep on losing the land. We keep on losing our ancestral way of living. Pastoralism is a way of life, and people see it as barbaric way of life. Different school of thought, others see it as a way of life, like as me. I see that this is the only livelihood for pastoralists. But these opportunities and this aspect of pastoralism has been put on edges, you know, on periphery. And on the assumption that climate change, you know, it's not sustainable. You know, climate change affects everything, not just livestock. It doesn't affect only livestock keepers. It also affects farmers. It affects agriculturalists, everyone. So for me, I think this is the time. Where did we come from? Where are we? And where are we heading to? What is the past? What is the present, and what will future be like for pastoralists? Case of Maasai, I can see Maasai is presenting, completely losing the land, just walking on the street, on the path with their livestock. From where I come from, we are really with this negative energy and negative forces. Pastoralists are becoming literally from different fronts, education, which is good, you know, sedentarized, environment, becoming environmental refugees. These are all factors which are really countering pastoralists where they are. For me, I feel that this needs further discussion, not just a one-hour discussion. We need to create a platform for those who are concerned. There are two schools of thought here. Those who are for pastoralists and those who are against pastoralism, seeing it as a barbaric way of life. But for us, some of us, do or die, we shall remain it. And we shall be firm, very firm on this way of life. Because there's nothing tangible that can replace pastoralism from where I am seated and from my long-term experience, where I've been and how I've been working for the last 30 years in this work and trying to champion all of us for pastoral to survive the vagary of negative thoughts and passive minds. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Isako, and for calling for an alliance between all pastoralists across countries and continents. I think can be really important, and we are all hoping that in the context of the International Year of Rangers and Pastoralists, there will be more opportunities for exchanges. I want to pass on to Nasingoi for a reaction to your comments, but I will add one question for her that has come in the chat. So it looks like pastoralist institutions are at risk, not only by limited attention of policymakers, but also because of rural-urban migration, especially of the youth. And this migration of the youth away from the communities is also threatening pastoralist institutions. Do you have any response also to that? Thank you.
Thank you. I think I need to respond first to Isako. It is true that we are still lagging behind, but I think we have to decolonize our minds. We have to decolonize the concept of conservation and the climate resilience strategies from all levels of education so that we can come with an alternative way of conservation. Therefore, we have to challenge the fortress conservation issues, the carbon credit issues, by coming up with policies, with our visions of conservation, because we are so much rich in our traditional knowledges of conservation. We bring this up and share it with the policymakers and everyone so that they can see that we also have an alternative to what they're doing, which will be more productive to our land. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I want to highlight you're referring also to the Maasai Conservation Vision, which is a document that you produced last year, also coming out of research. And we can also share maybe links for that in the chat. So I will pass on to you if you want to address the issue of migration of the youth away from their communities. And what impact does that have on your communities and on the future of pastoralist institutions? Thank you.
It's totally true that we are now facing like a big challenge. The young people are migrating from the rural areas to urban areas. And I can speak from my own perspective, where I come from in Loliondo. Before eviction, it was not really a big issue, people going to the towns. We only remain in our village, but now during eviction, we don't have any more livestock. The livestock were confiscated, and now we don't have any other option. The small kids, like a 12-year-old, 13-year-old, dropping out of school, going to nearby places in Kenya, like Nairobi, especially Kisumu. And it's so sad because the effect is so bad. Many killings are coming from that side, and they like life is really hard for them in that situation. So I can really see the impact negative impact that was caused by that eviction. And I can say that if the eviction did not happen in Loliondo, maybe many of our young men would have not been fleeing from our village to Kisumu, to Nairobi, and those other areas.
Thank you so much. Okay, I'm continuing with the questions we received in the chat. There is one question about drought. Drought, which is also eroding pastoralism, which was addressed already by some panelists. And there is a question around commercializing pastoralism. Maybe the person who raised this question can explain a bit what they mean. This is Lema Belai. And the third question raised by this person is, there is increased competition between pastoralism and agriculture, and the latter is promoted more by policymakers in some countries. What experiences exist in that regard? And indeed, we know that there is experiences with promoting pastoralism, agriculture also in dry lands that are not really suited for agriculture. So I don't know if Saverio or Michael, you want to address one of those questions.
I think it goes back to the issue of land, how we organize land use and recognize competing land uses. Because it's not either or. It's not like it is impossible to have, you know, livestock keeping and crop production coexist. It is possible. The problem has always been that the policymakers think that crop production is superior and all policies are geared towards making everybody a crop producer. So if you go to Turkana and you see a green belt, which is a dry season grazing area, you see that as an opportunity to bring farming into Turkana. So if we recognize pastoralism as a legitimate land use system and production system, and therefore promote its use, realizing that land is space which has to be shared, it's the role of governments to ensure that they create systems that allow for competing land uses to be able to survive together. It's not impossible to do. And I think it's just a question of asserting the right of livestock production as a land use system to be taken into account anytime we are thinking about how to organize the way land is used.
Thank you so much. I understand Joseph also wanted to add to this point.
Yes, mine is very simple. As a lawyer in Tanzania, if you bring livestock to someone's farm, that is a crime that you can go to prison for 7 years for destroying someone's farm. If a farmer come and cultivate the pastoral land, it's never a crime. Of course, I agree with you. I just wanted to say in that simple language how the policies are crafted. So what does this mean? It means continuous taking away of the pastoralist land because one is not a crime and is being promoted. And by the way, because many people see it's an awkward system. And I think that is very important to highlight. That is not just some small discrimination is in the law. If the livestock dies because there is no grazing area, because of cultivation, for example, because of farming, no one sees anything. But if it's the farmer, it's a crime. Then I want to say something about the drought. One important thing we should think all remember, the climate change has been forever. It's not a new phenomenon. At least in the Maasai context, if you got a bit of the history, Maasai first, and particularly those in the East African Kenya and Tanzania knows, before the turn of the last century, the Maasai first, one of the serious crises in smallpox, then come drought. That killed almost 90% of the livestock. So it's not a new phenomenon. But it's very important to understand how sometimes which kind of economy can we sustain to sail through that complex situation? Pastoralism is one of the best. And when people are mobile, it's not because they are hopeless. Even the snow, the wildebeest knows, we have to migrate because they're intelligent. They are in Kenya sometimes, then Serengeti, then to Ngorongoro, because they know how to manage the land. The pastoralist equally knows. So this is how we can sail through failure of rain, diseases, and many other complex issues related to drought. So that mobility is very important to address that. And which I said earlier, not only in East Africa, it is all over the world. So we want to address the issues of drought, climate change. Pastoralism is one of the best ways you can contribute. We're not saying it's a perfect system, but it's one of the best. You cannot do farming in the desert. You have camels in the desert and different others. So we need to learn how can these people sustain. It is only when we free our mind to listen is when we get the right answers that are not taught in these universities of the world.
Yeah, maybe I just said something and it's very relevant to what Michael has just said. As another example from my village, we had like separated places for, we had a place for farming and we had another place for grazing. But now due to our government interferes with our traditional land use plan, now it's no longer the same because now we cannot have the same farms and livestock at the same time. So I think also our government should respect our traditional land use plan. I think in Kenya are better, but Tanzania is a little bit difficult. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And indeed, you are from Loliondo, where a lot of land was lost and people are now facing a scarcity of areas for grazing. Their livestock together with livestock confiscation leading to a lot of problems. I see that Saverio has raised his hand. There was also quickly just to mention a comment in the chat that dumping of nuclear waste in rangelands is also apparently a challenge. There was a nice article on this in Kenya that was shared also in the chat. Saverio, over to you.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to add that though, of course, competition with crop farming is very real, but it is not automatic and it's not a necessity. Just like disaster from drought is not absolutely an automatic. Competition with farming depends on how it is managed, and how it has been managed in the last 30, 40, 50 years is, of course, the result of a different political and economic interest, including in the promotion of chemical fertilizers that have broken the necessity for farmers to have livestock on their land in order to regenerate the soil. Now, all that is also changing again because of climate change and because the chemical fertilizers are becoming more and more scarce anyway on a global scale. So again, I would just wanted to say a word about the fact that it's not written in stone. It does not have to be necessarily a competition. There are places where it has not been, not even now, and it is essential for both sides. You know, pastoralists need to go to areas where there is crop farming during the season where it is not possible to keep the animals because of dryness, but where it is best to keep them during the wet season because it's the best pasture that find it there. And farmers need the pastoralists often to give them their animals, their own livestock, not to keep them in farming areas when they farm, and of course for the manure. So I hear that even in East Africa, in West Africa, has been happening for a very long time and often in a fairly institutionalized form. But I hear that even in East Africa, there is again an interest in manure. And manure is being collected at water points and sold at good price in Kenya, for example, and I probably in other countries, too, certainly in Sudan that I know of. So that's the, we can expect that to, and certainly should be encouraged and helped as much as possible. Although it goes against the interest of those who have the fertilizers to sell, but hey, choices have to be made.
Thank you, Saverio. And indeed, we didn't mention explicitly, but pastoralism also contributes to farming, right? Through the manure cycle, if we do it intelligently. So very important. There is a question in the chat from Thomas, calling us from Austria, concerning the issue of building alliances. He's wondering which other groups, ethnic groups in East Africa, in addition to Maasai. Maasai are world famous and they are well represented today, but indeed there are other pastoralists in Eastern Africa. So which other groups have traditionally pursued pastoralism and could be key players in building these alliances to promote pastoralist policies, but also to resist soil carbon credit schemes that are being launched in different parts of Kenya and Tanzania and other places? I don't know who wants to answer this question. Joseph?
Okay. Yes, they are. And I think there are many. I can mention, for example, in Tanzania, we have, beyond the Maasai, we have the Barbaids community, who are typically pastoralists in all forms. Of course, we have the Skuma community, which is one of the largest communities in Africa, in Tanzania. Of course, they are agro-pastoralists, but they still keep a lot of livestock. That's for Tanzania. Crossing the border to Kenya, because actually in East Africa, then you go to even Rwanda, you go to Uganda, is somewhat kind of a pastoral community, because now East African communities are very large, going all the way to Somalia. And it's full of pastoral people. Yeah, maybe Michael can also say something about Kenya, either Ndoroise who are both hunting and pastoral at the same time, but going all the way to Baringo is pastoral people.
Thank you, Joseph. I don't know, Michael, if you want to add, and maybe some thoughts on the potential for alliances between pastoralist groups across different countries.
Maybe just to say, I mean, Katelo said he was from the north, and he mentioned, I think, three different counties in the north. The whole of the north is pastoralist, so there's a huge group of pastoral communities that is not just the Maasai. The Maasai are the most popular, but they're not the only ones. And the challenges they face are shared across different groups in the region, not just in Kenya, but also in Uganda and in Somalia and in Ethiopia and in Sudan. So the potential for alliance creation is really huge. I think we have to explore how to do that and use the International Day of Religion as a pastoralist as a mechanism, framework for pushing that.
Thank you. I see that Isako wants to quickly intervene, and there are links being shared in the chat, so I encourage you to check, and I encourage you all to review the policy brief and the research report that we are launching today. There's a lot of activity in the chat, and maybe when we send you the recording of the event, we can try and link again the research report and the policy brief in that same email. Yes, over to you, Isako.
Thank you very much. I've just put on my chat those pastoralists who are there, and of course they are there. Like you see, pastoralists are all across. To the north, the entire north, the northern Kenya is pastoralist. This is arid and semi-arid land. Their main livelihood and livelihood is in, you know, I can't mention all of them, but I've just mentioned a few there. But they extend even to southern Ethiopia, like Maasai in Kenya. There are pastoralists all across, bordering the southern Ethiopia, and even to the north, and even to the south. So these are everywhere. These communities are everywhere. Because they move where there's pasture and water, and there's no limitation. They don't need any passport to cross to external borders, you know. For them, water and pasture is where the availability is, where that's their home. So it's not just Maasai, but they're there in huge numbers. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. So I think this is a really nice way to end this conversation, to call for more exchanges and alliance building between pastoralists, but also between pastoralists and researchers, to address some gaps we have in pastoralism understanding and knowledge. I will just pass on quickly for a concluding word from our panelists. Just one takeaway or last thing you want to share as a last message. Any concluding words?
Yeah, I think for me, my takeaway is the building alliance. We need to be strong together and find other people, because unity is strong. Umoja ni nguvu. That's right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Mine is very quick. Pastoralism is a way of life. That I think we agree. But importantly is the challenges facing pastoralism. Substantial part of it is man-made. Is not nature-induced. So if we are to change our policies, our way of thinking about pastoralism, then we can be able to address much of the challenges facing pastoralism.
Thank you so much. Nothing, guys?
Thank you so much. My final words are that we need to develop our visions as pastoralists. Then we advocate for our visions to be implemented in all sectors, and use our vision as a legal hook to all investors who are trying to invest on our land, or to all countries that aid our countries in any form of aid, to condition whatever aid, whatever support in response to our vision. Thank you.
Thank you. And indeed, if we can encourage all development aid and policies and programs and make sure that they align with this vision, I think we can go already a long way. Saverio and Michael, any closing words? Okay, Michael?
I just want to say one thing, and I say this especially for the young people here. There's a lot that is wrong and a lot of reason to be, you know, to be pessimistic. But I also think it's important to recognize that we've really come a long way in this conversation about pastoralism. I mean, when I first joined this space 30 years ago, this kind of thing couldn't even happen. And I think it's important to recognize those small gains and make them the basis for advocacy. Let's not stay overly negative. Let's also be positive about the opportunity and the way forward for pastoralism. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And indeed, I think we have a lot of educated pastoralists today and very smart people sharing their experiences and their visions for the future. Really important. I want to highlight also in the chat, there is a message from Julia Van Stenis from Vétérinaires Sans Frontières in Belgium. They are the one organizing the Pastoralist Film Festival on behalf of CELEP or part of CELEP Network. And she put a link in the chat that I invite you to check because you will have free access to films about pastoralism from around the world. And you will see indeed that there is such great similarities, but also differences, of course, according to context, but similarities in how they operate and the challenges that they are facing. Okay, so with this, thank you so much. I see that Michael is sharing the Maasai vision, and we thank you all so much for your participation, and I want to thank again Asta and Sitsi for hosting us and making this event possible. And thank you to the interpreters. Okay, bye-bye, everyone. Bye-bye.